He wants to know if he can start, Pastor.
Is that all right, Larry? Okay. If you can't hear, please let us know, and we'll speak a little louder. We don't have the speaker on. I've been informed that we are being recorded. And the only thing wrong with being recorded, it doesn't correct the English. But generally, we will make a few comments, mainly because we have talked to so many people, and I'd kind of hate to repeat what maybe most of you already heard. And if you ask questions, then we'll know that we haven't covered that ground before. But I do want to comment first that Larry Collins here and Rudy Edmond are doing an excellent job in explaining about Holden. And if you haven't been to their sessions, you should make it a point to go, because there's a great deal of information being disseminated through that source. To start this out, when I look outside and see the day the way it is right now, which is relatively calm and not too rainy, it reminds me when I came here 44 years ago in June. I got into Chelan the night before and got on the boat at 8:30, and it rained all the way up the lake and rained all the way to Holden. And I got into what is now Honeymoon Heights at 5 o'clock that evening. As the road that you came up from Lucerne was not in at the time. They just had a road good enough for a bulldozer to drag heavy equipment, and that was about it. They had a tram from the lake shore up to the top level where the road begins to level out. And when we got up there, they had a truck for us that was called the Silver Goose at the time, and after I had traveled 12 miles, I found out why they called it the Silver Goose. But we drove through this area, and there was nothing here at that time. There was just a little bit of logging being done and a little bit of clearing, but no evidence of a town site as you see it today. And we went on up the road, almost to the ballpark, where we turned and went across the bridge and came to another little tram. And that was a service tram run by a donkey engine. And we had to walk up the hill. It was kind of muddy. And as I say, I got up there at the office at 5 o'clock that night. And I'm not too reluctant to say at that point I was quite discouraged. I didn't know for sure what I was getting into. The clouds were almost down to the level of the valley here. It was very dark and dreary. And I thought, well, I'd come up with another man. We looked at each other and we looked around at what we had there and says, well, let's stay long enough to have at least some money. We didn't have a penny in our pocket when we landed there. Let's make enough money so we can get out of here and go someplace else. Well, to digress a moment, it took me 15 and a half years to get to that point, and I changed my bedroll and a tin suitcase to a lovely wife and two lovely daughters and a van load of furniture when I left, so, and I was out of debt. But that was the main mine area at that time. There were several bunkhouses. There was an engineering office and a kind of an accounting office. Had a little commissary and post office. And I think there were At that time, two or three of the top staff that had their families with them, and the rest were all single people. And they assigned me to a tarp paper shack bunkhouse, which had maybe, as I recall, maybe 14 or 16 double bunker beds around the wall. And these were just steel frames with a very simple spring and a kind of a lumpy mattress. But that was to be my home for several months. There was no privacy. The heat was furnished by an oil drum with some, but we used green logs and diesel oil to burn. Sometimes we burned the floor and sometimes we smoked up the interior. I think it would have been better if we had made a teepee out of it. But the remarkable part of it was at that time you heard no complaints from the men about the conditions that they worked under there. It was amazing how they adjusted to this, and they liked it. And I think one of the reasons they liked it, we had a cook, I think he weighed 300 pounds. And once they got him up there, he was reluctant to leave. And it was a good thing, because he did furnish good food. And the men used to line up somewhat similar to this that we see here. It was rather remarkable to me, and it was interesting to me to see people line up for dinner or lunch or breakfast. But unfortunately there, we had a very narrow door for maybe about 100 people trying to get through all at once. And it was quite a squeeze to get in, but they made it. But at that time, we were working 7 days a week. There were no days off, so it was around-the-clock work, 24 hours. And as I recall, I think I was making about $4 a day. And that's $120 a month. There was no overtime or anything like that. And working in conditions in the mine, like any new operation, was something to be desired. It's no fault of who the designers were at that time. It just takes time to get the things in proper order. But going to work in the mine, you get 50 feet inside the portal and you couldn't see the daylight behind you. Sometimes you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. But you found your working place and you did what work you were assigned to do. The men had very little sympathy if somebody couldn't take it. In other words, if somebody got sick, the poor fellow was ridiculed. And 9 cases out of 10, he eventually quit and left. He just couldn't take the ribbing from some of these real hard rock miners that had been their profession for years, and they prided themselves in being able to rough it. And furthermore, with miners, they had a tendency to play tricks on the greenhorns. They'd send them after stope wrenches, and poor guy would look for several hours before some supervisor caught him and gave him the definition of a stope wrench. And they used to also set up their column bars for drilling. And the old-timer always had the trick of loosening that bar, hoping that a greenhorn would come on and let the whole thing fall over the top of him. And that sometimes happened. The miner that knew his business, the first thing he did, he'd tighten up everything. A fellow that hadn't done much mining would grab the machine, and sure, as soon as he put the pressure on it, the whole thing would fall on top of him, and everybody'd stand there and laugh at him, and nobody'd help him. So he'd have to lift up this 300 pounds by himself and get himself back into operation. I just mentioned a few of these things of how men reacted at that time and what their attitudes were. I might also say that some of them were on the run. They'd gotten in trouble someplace and they were coming here to work. They had different names. But as a whole, they were a fine group of people. Now, I've just mentioned a few things. I hope that I can spark your curiosity that you will ask us questions. I do want to say this, that for us as young engineers, it was extremely important that we had a wife that was very unusual. And I was fortunate that way that I did have a very unusual wife. It takes an unusual woman to come into something like this. I'd warned her, but she didn't pay any attention to me. I remember when we started going together in college, and I told her, "You keep fooling around with me and you'll end up in a tar paper shack." Well, she did. And she was a tremendous help in my career, and particularly in a place like this. I think it takes special people with a special type of attitude and faith to come to work under the conditions that we did when we started this place. So with that, I'd like to have you bounce questions off of us. And yes.
What's a stope wrench?
That's a stope is an opening underground where the ore has been mined out. So to get a greenhorn, if he's working in a stope, we tell him, the fellows that tell him, "You go get a stope wrench to help us out." And it was just a fictitious tool. It's the same. Further along those lines, as an example, a conveyance that will go up a shaft is called a cage. This is for taking men up to the various levels so they wouldn't have to climb ladders to get to the working place. And during the war, we got so many green people, we had to change the name to Elevator. They understood this, so all right. So that's the way, if they feel comfortable with this, we won't call it a cage anymore, we'll call it an elevator. We weren't very happy with that, but that was fine. But what got worse is we got men. I remember one time that a shift boss sent a man to the shaft station to get what was called a liner. Well, a liner, definition of that is it's a rock drill machine. And the shift boss thought he understood this. Well, he went to the shaft station and he waited and nothing happened. Well, about a half an hour, 45 minutes, he thought, "Well, I better go see what happened to that fella." So he went back along the drift, and here's this man coming with a little dolly. He says, "Boss, I had an awful time loading this thing, but here it is." And he had a transformer on the flat car instead of the rock drill. So we had to change the terminology as time went on for different types of people coming underground. And as we worked here, there are different sets of people all through to finally coming to the houses. Maybe we'll go into that a little bit more. But another question?
What changes were there here during the war years?
In what way? With people?
With people, work practices.
Well, let's take people first. The first group of people were the construction group or the development group that started to get the mine ready. And these were extremely hardy people and very proud and very hard workers and liked to rough it. It didn't bother them when they got up in the morning, for instance, and maybe had to scrape the snow off the floor to get their stockings and shoes on. That didn't bother them. That was the way it was. That was good. Finally, when this area was ready, which was in the winter of 1938, then they moved off the hill, out of these bunk houses where there was groups living together, and all shifts going back and forth, and trying to get some sleep was a problem. and moved down here where there was steam heat at the time, and two men to a room, much better beds, a closet to put things away, a little bit of privacy, and the griping started. And I had a difficult time understanding this. Now, this wasn't all people. It was I'd heard more griping down here than I did up there on the hill. Well, then some of these more hardy individuals drifted someplace else, went to work. And another group kind of took their place, but had probably more family connections, say, in Chelan and Wenatchee, although we did have quite a few of those people come in during the construction phase, too. And I might say that I don't know whether it was an endearing name or whether it was a derogatory name, but they were called apple knockers. And the reason they were called apple knockers, they worked in the orchards, and they didn't like that too well, so they heard about this, so they wanted to come up here and work. Well, they had to be taught everything. And these also, when we say after we moved down here, these men would then, they might work for 8 weeks, 12 weeks, and ask for 5 or 10 days off to be with their family for a while. Well, that was good for a couple of years, and then the family man began to say, well, why do I have to be separated from my family? You remember, this was at the heart of the Depression, and as the Depression wore off, things began to get a little better, and it became more competitive to maintain people in our operation. Well, to help these people that had families and wanted to be with them, caused Winston to come into the act. And people built their own homes. They might spend anywhere between $1,500 and $2,000 to build their own home there. And the company would help them as much as they possibly could. They would buy their own lumber. They would, many cases, would do even their own wiring and their own plumbing in their home. And this became then a more family-oriented. And the school was put in right away, and we had school here through the 8th grade. And we had quite a bit of recreation for that time anyway. We had the bowling alley. We had bowling leagues during the winter. We had softball teams, and those got rather spirited, and having the miners against the engineers and diamond drillers against somebody else. And it was all good, clean fun. But then another few years passed, and then these people begin to wonder, well, why should we be so far away from the bright lights? And they begin to drift away. And then the next step was to convert some of these, what we call the bunkhouses, which are lodges now, into apartments. And started to cater to another group of people. The single people, the people that were living single status, were getting less and less. Now, in the mine itself, we had to change technology and methods there, too. We started out in the beginning here at the top of the mine working down, and at the top of the mine, we used what was called a powder blast system. And there were, say, coyote holes driven to the extremities of the ore bodies, and then these coyote holes were charged with, maybe depending on the burden or the configuration of the ore body, anywhere from 25 to 50 cases of powder in each end of this coyote hole. And one case weighs 50 pounds. And we used to take the powder out of these boxes and stack it in there. And we'd use electric detonators and run the wiring. And then we'd backfill these with dirt, with the broken ore that was there. And then we would set this charge off. And the charge could be all the way from 200 to 300 cases of dynamite at one time, or 350. Needless to say, it kind of shook things up. You could feel it all over the area. and you'd see the dust fly out of the portals. But then from that, we went to long-hole drilling, which was a much cleaner method of mining and less disruptive. We changed from ore drawing through what we call bulldoze chambers to scraping the ore to a main raise system. And all these mechanization and improvements cut down the number of men that was required to operate the mine. And this, again, helped us in the matter of recruiting because we needed less people to do the work. So we, for instance, a mucking machine, using a mucking machine and a small one-ton battery locomotive, one man could do the work of four or five men with modernized equipment. And this is how we overcome some of the manpower problems. Yes?
John, I think I would want to say something because John's too modest to say this. But John came here out of WSU as a young mining engineer. He was an All-American football player. He played in the East-West game out of WSU. And then he came here as an engineer and didn't let anyone know except the head men that he was an engineer. He wanted to know the business from the ground on up. So that's how his background. But, and also, in adding, his son was one of the captains on the PLU football team this last year that won the national championship. But what I want to ask you about, John, is you mentioned about the snow slides here and how important they were and that where you built your house. And I think that the group would be very interested in hearing about that.
Okay, sure. Be glad to share that. You probably wonder, why was this built here? And then there was a vacant area, and then Winston was built. And why was the mine site where we had originally was not in any particular problem as far as snowslides were concerned? Well, in each instance, you will see that there's quite a gully on each side of these areas, and usually there's a little hump that comes out, and right at this hump is where these camps were built. And they were protected from the snowslides. The snowslides would go around them. You'll find the same thing here at this site. There's a snowslide to the west of us, snowslide area to the west of us here, and then there's another one just to the east of us. We lived in Chalet 7 up here, and a snowslide came down within 200 feet of the back of our home 1 year. And then Winston being the same way, there's another snowslide area just to the west of the Winston extremity. And there was no snowslide that ever bothered that area. But we had to be careful in going back and forth because we had this snowslide to worry about here. And then going up to the mine or going up to Honeymoon Heights, we also had the snowslide to the east of us there and one to the west of us. And those of us that were living there at the time kind of help each other. And when we felt the danger was such that it wasn't good sense to walk across these snowslide areas, we would then go to the 1500 level and walk into the mine, get into the cage, go up to the 1100 level and come out that way and come into our home from there. And all the time that I was here, there's only one person that was killed in the snowslide. We've had some close ones. We had two men that were out on the dump up there on the 800 level, and the snowslide came down and caught them in their tram car and shuttled them down to the 1100 level. Bruised and scared, but that's about all. And I think we were fortunate, but we also knew when the danger period was, which helps. I know we were told, if you've got a lot of big trees, don't ever worry about a snowslide coming through. Well, it makes sense. But 1 year down the road, I don't know how many miles down below us here, 4 or 5 miles, snowslide didn't pay any attention to that and went through those big trees, and trees like that were just sheared off right at the root level. And there has been times that people have told me, I didn't see this, where a snowslide has come down this side and gone partway up this side. Come right down in the valley and started up the other side. And it's difficult to try to explain to somebody how serious a snowslide can be until you see one. Then you don't have much argument anymore. And the only time, another time, a snowslide came down on the west side of the area that you know as Honeymoon Heights, and they had built the bunkhouse out just a little too far, and it hit the corner of it. Knocked a couple of guys out of bed. And they just got up and shook themselves, put the bed against the wall, and went back to sleep again. I'd like to have you ask my wife some questions. I think it'd be kind of nice to get the lady's side of. Yes, Corporal.
Well, I think that's the thing that women are most interested in. How did we get our supplies? When I first, came a year after Johnny did, after we graduated from WSC at that time, I got a teaching contract at Port Townsend, Washington. Those of you who are from the coast know that. And so I taught that year, and Johnny was here by himself. I think I saw him twice during that year. And we went home for Christmas and announced that we were going to be married. And I remember my mother's remarks that, well, I never thought you'd ever get around to it. Because here was Johnny up here, and they loved him like a son. And they thought she's going to let him get away from her. But that wasn't to be. And so we were married in June of that second summer. And I came up... Well, after our honeymoon, we honeymooned on the coast, and after our honeymoon, I stayed with my folks about, well, I was to be there about a month, and Johnny was up here working on his tar paper shack, getting it ready for his bride, and the people that were around there, and especially the people across the boardwalk, were watching him, and they said, why don't you have your bride come up? She can hand you the nails, at least, and she can stay with us if you don't have any place for her. So he got the message down to me, and it didn't take me very long to get on the boat and get up here. Well, I got off the bus, and I was met by a very lovely lady who happened to be the chief engineer's wife and who happened to live in Chalet 7. And so she took me up to Chalet 7, and I was to stay with her overnight and with her husband, and Johnny was to come down. He was on shift, by the way. He was on swing shift. And I'll just add this little thing that was interesting because Chalet 7 was the home I was to have 2 years later. And at the time, of course, I thought I'll never live in a scrumptious place like this, you know. So the next day, Johnny came down and took me up to my future home. And yes, it was a tar paper shack, but he had partitions in by that time. We had three rooms. We had three rooms and a path. And so I handed him the nails, and we got linoleum, and we got oilcloth, and we fixed those places up. We were about 12 to 14 brides, and most of these were young engineers who were marrying their sweethearts from University of Washington and the different mining schools around the area. And so we were all just sort of same age and all in love, of course, and so that was why it was called Honeymoon Heights, really. It was because we were all honeymooners up there. There was one couple that had been married 12 or 15 years, I think, and they were the old-timers. But Johnny loves to tell the story that we had a stork on a pole up there, and someone had made it out of plywood, and then Honeymoon Heights under it. And when the men would come off shift, you know, they'd turn the stork to face the Johnson's house, or they turn it to face the Bly's house, or to Vint Clark's house was up that way. And so it got to be a real joke with that stork in Honeymoon Heights. But we got our house all fixed up and settled in, and we lived there 2 years. And yes, there was no store, there was no fresh milk, nothing here. Once a week, we made out our grocery list. We planned our menus for the week. We made out our grocery list, and we sent it down to Chelan. And the grocers down there were wonderful. They were absolutely wonderful. If we ordered chicken, and they didn't have it, they'd send us rabbit. You know, they were great at substituting for us. We never got left out. You know, if they didn't have what we wanted, they sent us something. And so we had this problem, but it was fun because it was kind of like Christmas every Friday when the groceries came up. We just never for sure what we were going to have. And there wasn't a road to Honeymoon Heights. There was a trail. So naturally, things had to be gotten up there on this aerial tram. And we brides would stand up there at the top and watch our refrigerators come up on this thing, and we'd watch our Davenports come up, and we'd watch our groceries come up, all on this aerial tram. And once in a while, it would slip off a pulley, and then here'd be our Davenport, whatever it was, dangling around down here, never touching the ground, but always kind of perilous. And then, oh, the men would get down there, and they were so big and brave and strong, you know, and they'd put this back up on the pulley, and away would come our groceries. And so this was just great. We had the best times up there. We'd get together in neighborliness and parties, and no one ever came to Holden that she wasn't welcome with a coffee party or with a tea party. And we can give credit to our bosses. The people that were the officials here had originally come down from Britannia Beach in Canada. And as you know, the Canadians are very, very loving, very, very, I hate to say proper, but they just really know what should be done socially and what, not what's expected, but what they want to do. So when somebody new would come in, there'd be a tea party, and it wouldn't just be something flung together, you know. It would be a very, very fancy tea party with their silver and their best dishes and everything. So we brides then, of course, caught on pretty quickly that this had been done for us. And it's like the Magnificent Obsession, you know, you do for someone else. So it was very sociable community and a very loving community, a very caring community. And we all watched out for each other's children. After 4 years, we had a baby daughter. And then all our friends by that time had their children. And we were comparing, the husbands were, who had gotten a tooth and who was taking their first step. And, hey, come home, you know, you look in Joni's mouth. She didn't have any teeth yet. She was 9 months old and not a tooth in her head, and all these friends had children with lots of teeth in their mouths. And so this was sort of a competition that went on, but it was fun. And the borrowing, that was something that we really learned how to do, you know. If you decided you were going to have chocolate cake, and all of a sudden you found your chocolate can was empty, you didn't decide to make a white cake, you know, or a spice cake or something else. You went to the neighbor and borrowed some chocolate. And that was just expected. If your neighbor didn't come over and borrow in a day or two, you had to go over and check on her to see if she was well, because something had happened to her, because this was how we got together, you know, just sort of having this little thing in common. And but our supplies came up, I think, about 4 years later, or after we'd been married 4 years, or here 4 years. They put the store in.
Yeah, it was several years after.
And it was, in those days, you know, it was a supermarket for us, because there was fresh milk, there were fresh vegetables and fruit. Not a lot, not a big variety, but a lot.
Where was the store?
Pardon?
Did the store
I'm not sure just when that came in. I think this is roughly that it was about it's after the war sometime. The person that we'd been sending our grocery orders to thought maybe he'd pay to put a store up here. And he put a grocery store in a butcher shop. And whether it was successful for him or not, I don't know. It was in where the paint shop is now.
Were you still living on Honeymoon Heights then, or were you down here?
No, we were living down here then.
Yes, the I mentioned the chief engineer's wife met me at the bus, and by that time everything was going well, and the man that they had brought down from Canada, Mr. Lipsey, to be the manager here, then was taken out to go another mine somewhere else. So Mr. Curzon, who was the chief engineer and lived in Chalet 7, was moved down into the manager's house, which is Chalet 1 now. And then my husband was promoted to mine foreman, and they moved us down off of Honeymoon Heights, me in tears, into Chalet 7. And hating to leave my little honeymoon home up there, but knowing that this was something that we were privileged to be given this home and to be able to live there. The school was built, and I did a little substitute teaching, but not enough to really amount to anything. But we were very, very busy. We didn't have, someone has asked about church services here, and I think that question might come up. We didn't have regular church services. We had visiting pastors or priests. Priests would come in perhaps more regularly than others. Whether the Catholics needed to make confession more often than the rest of us or not, I don't know. But the priests did come in. Of course, we were always welcome. They tried to make them ecumenical as possible, and anybody was welcome. And then other people would invite their pastor. Our pastors came in, my pastor from La Crosse, Washington, and we're always very proud and happy to have our own pastor here. I was privileged to be in the group that formed the first Sunday school, and all the children in the community came to Sunday school. It was ecumenical. We kept it just as ecumenical as we possibly could, and it was very successful. The Sunday school was very successful. In the summertime, we would shift to an evening because Sundays were big days for the miners. I'm a farmer's daughter, so that slipped out. For the miners and the engineers and the staff people to take off on these gorgeous trails and spend the weekend or the day. So Sundays were not good for church services at that time. Our ecumenical services, I mentioned, were always evening, and our Sunday school did meet in the wintertime on Sunday, but during the summer months in the evening. At maximum, 1,600?
Somewhere around that.
People.
1,500.
That's
women and children. And might add, when I got promoted, we were been living in our home. We had just spent some money to put on a bathroom. We had inside plumbing then. And it was a couple of months after that I was told to move down to Chalet 7. And I went home and we talked it over, and I could see a reluctance to move, so I went back the next day and I said, I'm not going to do it. I said, we like where we are. And the manager just looked at me and says, well, it's either that or you're fired. So needless to say, we came down here. We took our furniture out up there and put it down here. And I'm not sure whether I could find it when we put it in there. So Ruth had to go back out to Spokane and get us back in debt and get us some more furniture.
What happened to your investment you had in the tar paper shack?
Well, I was just labor, and fortunately I had two friends of mine from college that wanted to help. And they helped me with this. And I had the two neighbor boys, too. I think there were about 4 and 6, and I was having quite a time with them. And I thought, well, there's one way to solve this. I gave them a bag of nails and a hammer apiece, and they went over in a corner, and I had them start pounding nails in the floor. Well, I didn't think they would work that fast, but that, if you ever saw an iron floor, that was it. they did an excellent job on that. I've had somebody ask me about rumors. And a place like this, it's just amazing what a rumor can do. If you started a rumor at one end, it'll beat you to the other end, and you wouldn't recognize it when it came out. Unfortunately, I made an offhand remark one time that I was sorry for afterwards, but You have to appreciate that when the men moved off the hill and came down here, we had to walk from here to the dry and change up there on the 1500 level. And then when we were finished there, got our mining clothes on, then we had to walk on up the mountain and either report to the 1100 or the 800 and the 550. And it took quite a bit of walk. I think some of you have walked that. So you can imagine what time we started out in order to get there. Well, the big push then was to get this number one shaft online, and what was holding it up was a cage in order to transport the men from level to level. Well, I heard so much fuss about this cage, so I offhandedly remarked that, well, they brought the cage up on the barge and the darn thing fell off and went in the lake. Well, you can't imagine what that started. Boy. It got to the manager at that time, and he was quite an individual. He jumped about 20 feet in the air, and he says, what's the matter with that stupid outfit in Chelan that allowed that cage to fall off the barge? And he gets on the phone. He bawled this guy off before he even had a chance to say anything. He says, he finally got in. He says, there's nothing wrong with that cage. It's on the barge. How do you know it's on the barge? Well, I put it on. Well, how do you know it's still on there? So the poor fellow had to get out of his office, jump in his car, and drive towards 25 Mile. He caught up with the barge, and there's the cage sitting right on top of him. So he goes back to the office and phones the manager, and this time he had something to say. But at any rate, the cage finally got here, and it settled that. It's just amazing how rumors will get around in an area like this, and a lot of them are deliberately started by people that like to see what happens.
I think the mothers that's here probably changed. Would be interested to know about the stork could never get into Holden. It's just too high and deep in here. So when we were expecting our babies, we had to go out, as I hear people around here say. I'm surprised to hear people, and it must have been carried on through, because my family would sort of look at each other and smile when I'd say, well, we'll be out, or we came out, or something like that, like we'd gotten out of jail or something. But anyway, we had a very, very fine doctor. We didn't just have one doctor either. We had several fine doctors here. But the doctor at the time that my babies were born, Dr. Wam, was here, and there were two nurses always on duty in the hospital. And he would give us excellent prenatal and postnatal care. And about the time he decided that this baby was about due, he'd say, well, I think you'd better go out. So we would have to get on the boat and go down, in my case, to my parents' home, which was down near Colfax, Washington. And that was where the hospital was. So I went home to my folks to have my first baby. It was the war. Johnny couldn't leave because every little ounce of copper was very, very important, and he had a responsible job. So here I was waiting there for my baby to come. And she was born in Colfax. And then 2 years later, the same thing occurred, and I went out and had Arlinda was born also in Colfax. Her daddy happened to be able to be present for Joni's birth because I was induced, and so I had a little time to let him know that I was going into the hospital and the baby would be coming. But with Linda, it was different. He missed her birth, and it all came by, not carrier pigeon, that would have been nice if we'd had that, but through the Washington Water Power Company, and then this man would repeat it to Miss Ann, so hey, you have another little baby girl. And someone has asked if there was a baby born. Yes, one baby was born in Holden. A little girl came a little fast, and little Mary Holden Webb was born. Her parents lived up at Winston, and her daddy and mother gave her the second name of Holden. I don't know where she is. I would love to know. The Holdenites have a reunion the third Sunday in August, and as many of us try to get together as possible. It seems to be dwindling off now. I think the old-timers maybe are beginning to fade away. Miners don't die. They say they just fade away. But anyway, we hope someday to trace Mary Holden Webb down and find out where she is. She's the only baby I know of that was ever born in Holden.
You're
Oh, where are they?
That's where the miners built their homes. There was about 100. It was a construction contractor in here at the time, and he did quite a bit of work up there, and for some reason or other, they hung the tag Winston on it.
Winston Construction Company.
You had a question here a little while ago, I think. Over here? No? Anybody else?
What kind of government do you have when there were disputes, say, of a social nature that didn't have to do with the job?
95.
Well, yeah, we... Those of us that ran the operation were also responsible for maintaining law and order. We didn't have much of this. We had a hard and fast rule. Anybody that got drunk and disorderly was immediately discharged. And we made sure they got on the boat. And unfortunately, it was always my best men that would get in trouble. I started to keep a file on these individuals. I knew just about what their tolerance level was. I used to call them in the office and I'd say, well, I think it's time that I give you 10 days off. And they'd argue a little while, and pretty soon they'd say, well, maybe you're right. Maybe I better get out of here. And they'd leave, be gone 10 days. Sometimes they'd call me from Schlan, I'm broke, flat broke. So we'd advance them the money and they'd get on the boat and go back to work again. And any fights or like that, which was rare, we had to break it up. There were times that I was a call to the apartment sometime because this man's wife was having difficulty coping. And I'd try to sit there and listen to see what the problem was and try to answer the questions. But we tried to help each other out that way. Keep an eye on things to keep it orderly, not let it get out of hand. We could not let drinking get a hold in here with a lot of the women and children around and have something go wrong. We wanted to get it before it went wrong. We also had an agreement with the game department that if anybody broke the game laws, he'd be fired. As far as getting communications in here, we had what was called a carrier system that went along the electric, the 110,000 volt line. It was carried over that. And we had a telephone system. We had a small exchange in the main office. And this was connected to the various homes. Those were key people that had to be in contact with other people or with the job. And I like to tell the story about the time when a fellow was up here and he wanted to get married. And he wanted to do it by telephone. So he got this telephone and he called our man that was responsible for the office in Chelan. That was Mr. Ansel Snodgrass at the time. And he told Ansel, he says, I want to get married. Will you, here's the telephone number of my girl and I want you to call her and get her on the line. So he did. So this fellow made his proposal through Ansel to this girl, and the girl came back and said yes. So he went out and they got married. But we had no direct communications outside of getting to Chelan. Later on, it became a luxury as far as traveling. Somebody got enterprising enough to have a seaplane. And if you wanted to pay a little bit more, you could get down lake in a half an hour. Yes?
How was the fishing in the creek then?
The fishing in Railroad Creek, as far as I'm concerned, was just fair. not very many big ones in there, and it's very difficult to fish. Holden Lake was my favorite lake. Hart Lake is not an easy lake to fish. Dompke Lake was a good lake to fish. I like to tell people who do like to fish my first trip to Holden Lake to go fishing. Two of us went. We're the only ones there. The lake was completely frozen over yet, a lot of snow. But the outlet, which is Holden Falls, if you see as you walk up towards Hart Lake, for about 200 feet had small holes down to the water, which were about 10 feet down the water. And we dropped our line and hooked down in there, and we caught 40 trout in an hour and a half, and the biggest one was about 18 inches. And boy, were they good eating.
Perhaps the fishing note is a good note to close on. Seems like that's a very interesting subject around here.
We hope that we've given you a little different insight. I know I've forgotten some. I'll probably think of something I should have said. But we would like to have people know that the 15 and a half years we spent here was a highlight in our life. We enjoyed it here. We had a great time. Made a lot of wonderful friends. And it wasn't easy to leave when we left. It took our daughters a couple of years before they forgave us.
I've told my pastor, our friends, the Ericksons, that I can remember sitting down in our backyard up at Chalet 7 near this huge, huge fireplace my husband built there. And evenings after we'd had our meal out there, and we had lounging chairs out there, and I would sit there sometimes by myself and listen to the sounds of Holden and know that I'll never be at peace ever like I am here tonight. And it's been true. It's just a special, special place.